Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back with you here on The Punch Out, 27th of May, 2021. Very happy to be back with you here, as we always are. And we've got plenty for you here on the show, as we always do. We're going to talk a little bit about the elections that took place in Syria yesterday. We're also going to be talking about the country of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, if you will, making some moves as it concerns Israeli apartheid. But before we get to either of those two very important stories, we turn to the controversy over the origins of COVID-19. Well, since the beginning of the pandemic, the U.S. government has been furiously at least attempting to blame China for COVID-19. Whether we're talking about Donald Trump, Joe Biden, the New York Times, or Fox News, the idea that somehow China was hiding something that ultimately resulted in the pandemic becoming worldwide and killing millions of people has been inculcated all across the country to the point where it's actually become something of a conventional wisdom that China, quote unquote, did something wrong. The issue is back in the news this week because Joe Biden has ordered the U.S. intelligence community to look more deeply into the origins of COVID. He noted that they actually have no real idea what the origins are now and implied that the theory that it leaked from a lab, specifically in the Wuhan Institute for Virology, was at least as plausible as anything else. And this has set off a major round of speculation all across the media on this issue, yet again, with even many so-called adversarial commentators jumping on board the lab leak train. And there are a range of things to parse here. First things first, though. Whatever the origin of COVID, the blame for its rapid spread and hundreds of thousands of people killed in the United States is the result of the U.S. government not doing anything about something they had ample warning about. And there's a lot to the timeline overall, but for brevity's sake, think about it like this. The World Health Organization declared a global health emergency on January 31st. About a week after China had imposed a complete lockdown on 11 million people, 11 days after the CDC had already started testing for COVID at airports, and 27 days after China first informed the U.S. about the virus. But the first statewide stay-at-home order didn't come until March 19th. Think about that. January 31st, global health emergency. First statewide stay-at-home order, March 19th. I mean, just 2 days before he instituted major restrictions, Andrew Cuomo was telling New Yorkers, quote, there is no reason for excess anxiety, end quote. So again, the whole timeline of U.S. in action here is another story, but it's important to note that whatever happened in terms of the issue of the origins of COVID-19, even if it was the worst case scenario that this was a deliberate bio-assault of some sort, the U.S. was aware in early January that something serious was happening, and by the end of January that something really serious was certainly possible and already happening in some countries, yet they chose not to take much of any action at all at the governmental level until mid-March. So how is it possible to blame China when there were just months of sitting around without any sort of significant preparations? And with almost every major U.S. official downplaying the pandemic that had placed the world's most populous country in a total lockdown. Again, they had ample warning. They did nothing. So even in the worst case scenario, clearly the onus is on U.S. officials. But back to the origin story here. Now, from fairly early on, there were accusations, especially from the political right, that this was a leak from a Chinese lab by accident or deliberately. Now, the first problem here is, it isn't 100% clear that China is even the original source of COVID-19. In early January, a CDC study noted that there was a case of COVID-19 in a 4-year-old in Italy who it seemed contracted the virus in late November. The throat culture revealed that the positive test was from December 5th, And this follows earlier information from Italy, which noted the virus was present in wastewater as early as December 18th. At least one French hospital, which re-examined some information from the pre-COVID era, so-called, have stated that they think COVID was present in the country perhaps as early as November 16th. In another CDC study, researchers found coronavirus antibodies in 39 samples from California, Oregon, Washington, as early as December 13th to December 16th. In China, the first case of someone who showed up to the doctor with symptoms, it seems, was December 1st, while other analysis say it's possible that sometime between mid-October and mid-November, but that's a projection not based on evidence. But what you get here, the bottom line is it's not all that clear that the virus itself is from China. There's a lot of data points all clustered in the same general area around the same time of the year in terms of the end of 2019 and early 2020. So any theory of a lab leak from China, of course, has to reckon with the fact that it's not 100% clear China is the ultimate origin of COVID-19. Now we get to the heart of the matter, more or less. The real thing that puts weight behind the lab thesis is that there is a lot about the origin story of COVID-19 that isn't known. For one, it isn't even clear how exactly the virus jumped from animals to humans. So if that is in fact how it happened, but that's what the scientific consensus is so far, and that includes the most rigorous single study done by the World Health Organization, which has posited that it has a natural origin of some sort and that it either jumped directly from some animal to humans or from one animal to another animal and then on to humans. And that latter scenario is what the WHO considered the most likely. This quote-unquote zoonotic origin, as it's known, is, of course, a very common way that diseases spread. There are hundreds of adenoviruses and coronaviruses and rhinoviruses of all various types that have naturally evolved and eventually managed to get humans sick. SARS and MERS both exhibited this quote-unquote spillover effect, as it's known, from bats and camels, respectively. So while there are other points that make the lab leak theory in some form plausible, and we're going to get to that, it's important to note here that the weight of essentially all known science on viruses and current science on this virus speaks to a natural origin. So while there may be quote-unquote two theories, they are not, in fact, equal in weight. And one, the natural origin theory, has vastly more evidence behind it, at least at this point. And I also just want to point out here as an aside, one of the articles that's been hyped this month bolstering the lab leak thesis is from a guy named Nicholas Wade, who once argued differences in economic outcomes for different races is genetic. So just an aside, but I thought I'd put that out there. Anyways, back to COVID. Now, the thing about the lab leak story that is very important is that it is in fact true that there is quite a bit of research that goes on into dangerous viruses, research that is designed to make them more deadly, and a good bit of that research happens either in the United States or somewhere outside of it, but through American organizations that get a lot of support from the DOD, the NIH, and interestingly enough, USAID. And this sort of research is known as, quote, gain of function research. And there has been a number, actually, of fairly public controversies over this over the past decade or so. And it's also a documented fact that the risk of leaks from these labs is not zero, and that there are more incidents that take place than most people would want to expect. One thing that is true is that the Wuhan Institute for Virology is a high-level lab that deals in research with various coronaviruses, among other things. One other thing that is true is that several people involved in researching the origins of COVID now have ties to U.S. government-funded efforts to do research on coronaviruses, including gain-of-function research. So, hypothetically, it isn't outside the realm of possibility that there was a leak from a lab somewhere. And those are really the competing theories, was whether or not it came from a Chinese lab or whether or not the fact that many of these people are tied to American labs where they're doing gain-of-function-like research, that they're trying to frame the Chinese lab, essentially, but that there's a case that it's coming from a lab in America or connected to the intelligence military-industrial complex somehow. So that's out there. But there isn't really a smoking gun there. There's certainly a web of researchers tied to state institutions in both the U.S. and China doing research into COVID-like viruses, certainly in ways that may deserve more scrutiny and more transparency overall. Certainly the leaking of a dangerous virus like this is something that is known about and is discussed often as a big risk of this form of research. But there's not any more evidence of that than of a natural origin. In fact, there's far less evidence than the natural origin hypothesis. As one commentator put it, quote, one hypothesis requires a colossal cover-up in the silent, unswerving, leak-proof compliance of a vast network of scientists, civilians, and government officials for over a year. The other requires only for biology to behave as it always has, for a family of viruses that have done this before, to do it again, end quote. So yes, both things could happen. Both things are plausible, but they are not equally as likely to have happened in this situation, certainly not based on the current evidence. Now, calling the quote-unquote lab leak conversation a conspiracy theory elides the fact that, circumstantially, it's not outrageous to raise the issue. But again, recognizing that does not make the two explanations rest on equal footing. So the question you really need to ask yourself is this. Why is the issue of the quote-unquote lab leak coming back around now? After the U.S. starts to quote-unquote get over the hump in terms of what people are saying, turning the corner on COVID, maybe is another way to put it, all of a sudden, there's a major surge of stories from all political angles that the Chinese lab leak story is back in play. Well, it seems pretty obvious, right? Deflects blame away from U.S. officials bungling and furthers the central foreign policy goal of the United States, which is isolating China and crippling China's quote-unquote rise. Clearly, totally independent of this, the U.S. bioweapons apparatus must be discussed and looked into further. Clearly, there is a lot of deeply unethical research being done in a bioweapons armed race that is barely discussed. But pushing the idea that the lab leak story is likely rather than plausible overshoots the evidence and mainly just reinforces narratives designed to further war and militarism. Ireland has become the first EU country to take some form of action in relationship to Israel's illegal settlement project. The Dáil, that's the parliament in Ireland, voted in favor of a motion tabled by Sinn Féin to recognize Israel's settlement policy as de facto annexation yesterday. And there was a bit of wrangling that went on to get the support of more or less all the parties there, including adding in some language condemning quote-unquote all sides for violence in Palestine. But at the end of the day, the move has made headlines around the world because, in the words of Sinn Féin's foreign affairs spokesman John Brady, quote, "We are baldly stating that Israel is acting illegally under international law," end quote. Now, this, of course, has been clear for quite some time for anyone who wanted to see it. But for an EU country to enshrine the idea in law is clearly a blow to Israel's attempts to sanitize its apartheid policies. And Israel, of course, has vigorously protested the passing of this law. People Before Profit, it's a socialist group in the Dáil, tried to add an amendment to the bill that would have expelled the Israeli ambassador and placed sanctions on the country, but that amendment failed, 87-46. So ultimately, the move by the Dáil is mainly symbolic, but certainly notable because Israel depends heavily on a cordon sanitaire of sorts by powerful nations that prevents even the slightest level of accountability for their apartheid policies. And on top of that, it relies on those same nations to use their official institutions to promote just total fictions about what's going on in the ground. So the cracking of that consensus with even essentially pro-Israel politicians voting in favor reflects the inability of apartheid Israel to retain the total hegemony on the narrative in the West that has been so effective for them so far. And it's certainly also notable that about one-third of the Dáil was willing to sanction Israel. Again, it shows how seriously the pro-Israel consensus in the West is starting to crack. Syria had elections yesterday, and, well, you may not be surprised to know Bashar al-Assad won again. Most of the coverage in the West about the election is essentially just mocking the fact that it wasn't much of a contest and clearly was never going to be. However, all that being said, just dismissing it as an aside is more of an easy way to just dismiss the state of the country now, the frozen conflict that exists, and the total failure of U.S.-driven policy on this front to do anything other than deepen the conflict. The easiest way to think about the Syrian elections is basically as a form of demonstration. It's no secret the Ba'ath Party keeps a very tight hold on things in the government-controlled areas of Syria, so the elections are less about the contest and more a show of support for Assad and his leadership. And despite various accusations that some people feel compelled to vote for whatever reason, losing a place in a university, it's clear enough when you watch the videos, look at the photos, read various things, not just from this election, but the past several, including in the mainstream media like the New York Times that admitted this many times, that the throngs that you see at the various polling stations are not really an accident. And it's certainly not an accident that Assad was overthrown, whatever you may think of him, millions of people clearly prefer Ba'ath Party rule to the other option, which was and remains an extremist set of philosophies grouped under the umbrella of groups that claim to be motivated by Islam. And that, more or less, is why we are where we are now. The U.S., U.K., France, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE thought they could fund an army of these rebels to topple Assad. but they clearly underestimated his staying power and overestimated not only their own power, but the appeal of the ideologies of those who they were funding. And, as we now know, due to the intervention of Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah on Syria's side, plus those factors I just mentioned, they just failed to topple Assad. And now the conflict is essentially frozen. The plurality of the territory and the majority of the people are in areas controlled by Assad, and they seem, at least very relatively speaking, all right with that. The so-called opposition is more or less packed into Idlib, protected by Turkey, that also has occupied a sliver of land going a few miles deep all along the Turkey-Syria border, where they've also put various opposition supporters. And the Kurdish areas are run by the YPG, that's a Kurdish faction, but they are only able to maintain their hold because the U.S. is now involved in an open-ended occupation in northeast Syria, where most Kurds live. So unable to actually prevail, the U.S. has decided to just prevent anyone else from coming up with some sort of solution, because ultimately without them there, the most likely outcome would be the Syrian government taking over the majority of the territory and negotiating some sort of modus vivendi with Turkey and the Kurdish groups. Of course, that would mean total failure for the United States. So now they stay in Syria, they prop up the YPG government as a fig leaf for their own occupation, and in this way, they keep Syria from reconsolidating and prevent a strengthening of Iran and other forces opposed to the U.S. regional agenda. The U.S. is combining that with serious sanctions. If you can't win on the battlefield, starve them out, essentially. And the sanctions have created shortages of food and of medicine. They've caused inflation to skyrocket. They've given the black market a much, much stronger position in the economy. Some estimate that the poverty rate has gone up to 89%. So while it's easy to dismiss the Syrian elections as just a sideshow, it's deeply indicative of why this conflict has been so devastating. Western nations created a fiction that Assad had no support. They used that as a pretext to supercharge a civil war, and then, refusing to admit their defeat, they have been determined to freeze the conflict no matter the humanitarian cost to stave off a humiliating climb down from their regime change policies. So again, whatever you think of him, an Assad must go at all costs policies has only deepened the violence, ignored the realities on the ground, and intensified the misery of tens of millions. Clearly, a course correction is required. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.